Hi, I'm Jeannie Patel-Thompson from ListenToYourFreedom.com, and I'm talking with Stuart Thompson today about all the different ways an entrepreneur can get help financing their business growth from a bank or other possible sources. So let me tell you a little bit about Stuart first so you can kind of understand why he's a great person to ask and take advice from. Stuart started out with a company in the UK that manufactured small-run branded condiments. He then expanded into supplying major blue-chip companies like McDonald's, British Airways, and others. He started with dry products like sugar and sweeteners, then went into sauces and condiments, and became the largest portion packet manufacturer in Europe. Then Heinz, yes, the ketchup giant, bought that company for about $20 million in 1995. They mismanaged it for 6 years, at which point Stuart bought back the dry side from them, so just the sugar and sweeteners, for only 10 cents on the dollar. He built it back up to a thriving, profitable company and then sold it again 5 years later to a German sugar company for over $25 million. Okay, so at that point, Stuart decided he wanted to live in the USA, so he set up another company in Florida to provide small-run, branded sugar portions for clients ranging from small local restaurants to large airlines like Delta and American Airlines, cruise lines like Carnival and Royal Caribbean, and again, McDonald's. Stuart Thompson was the person responsible for introducing the sugar sticks concept to America and Canada. So for those of you who remember, sugar used to only come in those rectangular flat packets, and then all of a sudden it started appearing in these, you know, elegant little tubes, and that's the sugar sticks concept, and Stuart's responsible for bringing that to North America. So Stuart is a great person for us to talk to about this topic, not just because of his varied international experience with building, funding, and selling companies, but also because he's an assertive outside-the-box thinker. So I think we're going to have some fun on this call. And Stuart, thanks so much for helping us out here.
My pleasure.
Excellent. So let's start with this, Stuart. Tell us about the very first time you had to go to a bank for money. If your very first fundraising, you know, activity was with a bank, so what stage of growth was your business at, and what financial position were you in personally?
I had no or very little capital behind me, and I went to talk to the bank in England, and the bank wanted all sorts of guarantees and wanted to engage in all sorts of different conversations. My problem was I'd left a blue chip company and I had a mortgage. I had two children in very expensive schools, and my cash flow on my personal life was spoken for, and the bank wanted to intrude onto my personal life. So I had a couple of offers from the banks, but in the end, I decided I wasn't prepared to adopt a lower standard of living, and therefore, I shopped around to see if I could find someone with spare capital, somebody who had made their money, and somebody who was prepared to back me and I could make them more money. So in the end, I went with a business partner and not a bank, purely and simply because I wasn't prepared to accept the type of terms and restrictions that the bank wanted to place on a startup business.
Right. And then for your business partner, how did you structure that offer? Like, what did you say to him? Okay, this is what I need from you and this is what I'm prepared to give.
I gave them the opportunity to have equity in my business. I made sure that I maintained control. They wanted control, which I wasn't prepared to give up. So we set up a structure where we had different classes of share. I had A shares and they had B shares. And therefore, we were equal financial partners, but my shares carried two votes to every one of their shares. So they were able to give me substantial business funding, and they were going to be rewarded on an equal basis with me when it came to the any later lucrative payout. But when it came to running the business, if ever we were to fall out and it came to a board vote, I had two votes for every share and they only had one vote for every share. However, having said that, we never fell out.
You know, I have to jump in and say that's absolutely brilliant, because that you know, struggle or argument over control of the company is, I think, the number one thing that derails people from going into partnership. Because, you know, as you pointed out, if it's your business and you're running it, you really need to have control. But then the person coming in says, well, I don't want you to have, you know, 51% and I only have 49. And then the other really key thing about what you just shared is, from my experience, I've only had A shares as voting shares and B shares as non-voting shares. I did not even know that you could split it the way you just did by saying, okay, well, we each have 50%, but my shares get 2 votes and your shares get 1. So there's never going to be that conflict for, you know, growth or development, and one person is more, you know, risk averse than the other person. So then that's where I think all the conflict comes in, and that solves every single one of those problems very elegantly.
It worked well for both parties, and in the end, and one of the parts, just briefly on the introduction, this was even before we sold to Heinz. This was back in 1983, when I was actually starting the business and didn't have any customers whatsoever. We started completely from scratch, and the people I was talking to were involved in the vending machine business. They were slightly allied to my business. They weren't involved in portion control, but they had access to purchasing power of products that I needed to buy for my business. And so one of the points I would make, which I think is very relevant to someone, if ever you're looking for a partner, you don't want to meet somebody who's already been there and done it, but if you were to look for somebody who was like a cousin or a distant relative who were in a similar industry but not the same industry, and see what they could have to offer you. In my particular case, these people already bought a lot of sugar. But the sugar they bought was to be put inside a vending machine. So when I started my business, I could leverage their purchasing power.
That is fantastic.
It meant from a startup situation, I could buy cheap sugar from day one, although I actually have no buying power.
I love what you're saying, because you're saying don't just go looking for someone that has the money that you're going to need, but look for someone who has the money and be more strategic about it. What else can they bring to your business aside from money? What are the, you know, the non-obvious ways, like maybe just at the first look, but the non-obvious ways that they can kind of come in through back doors and support the growth of your business as well?
Ginny, there's lots of people out there with money and lots of people who are always wanting to invest and then take advantage of the person who's actually creating and doing the work. So very much so, if you're going to take outside investment, other than the money, which is the obvious driving force, what you've also got to look for is to say to yourself, what else can they do for me?
Yes. I love that. I think that's absolutely perfect. So in your opinion, you know, because what you described as to your financial situation at that point, I think is what most people, you know, when they're growing their business or they're in early stages are facing. You know, we don't have the personal equity, we don't have the personal assets, and of course a bank wants all of that as collateral, and they want, like you said, they were saying, well, you need to scale back your standard of living in order to do this. And I really like this idea to just, you know, go to the banks and see what they can do for you, and then make a decision. Do I want to go that route, or do I want to look for another way?
Two other points on the subject of banks.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let me say that European banks, particularly English banks, are an awful lot more commercial than North American banks. When I started my business in the United States, I had a lot of capital behind me. I'd already made my money, but I was starting again in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have an overdraft facility with the bank. The first thing the bank wanted to ask me for was a personal guarantee.
Yeah.
And I looked at the bank manager in the eye and said, I'm not going to give you any personal guarantees whatsoever. And he looked at me and said, well, if you go broke, who's going to pay back the loan? And I said, well, I'm not sitting in front of you telling you I'm going to go broke. So why are you raising the company? And the summary of that conversation was the bank did not want any risk.
Right.
me make this point to you nowadays, that interest rates are at the lowest level that they have been in living memory.
Mm.
And therefore, the bank need to make some money, because it's not an easy job that the banks are in nowadays, lending money and charging 2 or 3%, when in the past, banks lend money and make and charge 8 or 10%. So therefore, at the moment, the banks do not want any risk whatsoever. And it's, I would say to you, almost impossible to get a bank loan without giving a personal guarantee.
Right.
My point is, if you're going to give a personal guarantee to the bank, there are better places to go and find the money.
Talk to us about some other places. What are some other ways?
Well, there are areas where accounts receivable financing is a common place. I personally very much against that, because I find it very expensive, and I find it very restrictive. However, in some startup situations, the cost of invoicing and then debt collection and all the things related to that can be a barrier to somebody when they're first starting the business. And let me add, my first ever job was I was a debt collector. I was a credit controller. So when I started my business, I was aware of that. But a lot of people, when they're starting businesses, get very much involved in the front end, the sales and the marketing, but they don't have any accounting experience. And let's remember, a sale is only a sale when it's been paid for. There's no point in selling something if somebody's not going to give you the money for it.
So explain to me step by step how accounts receivable financing works. Like, what, let's say I wanted to do that. What do I have to do, and what would the, I'm assuming that's provided by a banking institution. What would they provide?
There are financial institutions out there. In Europe, it's called factoring. The name, that word doesn't translate into American. I'm sorry, I speak perfect American, but occasionally I lapse back into English. Factoring in Europe is very simply, you are selling your company's invoices. So if you sold a product for $100, the factoring company will pay you 85 cents on the dollar. And they're going to collect money for you. And therefore, they give you your money right up front. So you've sold your product for $100. And the day after, you get a check for $85 or $90. You've got the money in your bank immediately. They raise the invoice, and they do the debt collection. Now, for some people starting up in a business, that is a very good way to start. There's a big negative coming, but that's a great way to start, because when you've sold your first product for $100 and you've then got, you want to go and get the second product and sell that one for $100 and so on and so forth. So any entrepreneur is starting predominantly selling their products. Very few entrepreneurs start by collecting their money. You've got to sell something before you can collect the money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just one man and a dog, then you've got to spend all your time doing your selling. Therefore, the accounts receivable financing has its advantage. You go and sell your product for $100 and suddenly you've got $85 or $90 in the bank tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty on that is, if you work out, you're paying 10% interest rates.
Yes, exactly.
When money nowadays, you can achieve and you can go to the bank, you can get a mortgage on a house now and pay only 3 or 4% interest. So it works. But it's expensive.
Yeah.
And a lot of people start their businesses and go down that road. The difficulty with accounts receivable financing, it's a treadmill. Once you start on it, it's very, very difficult to get off.
Why is that?
So I would advise people to try not to get on it in the first place. And I come back to my opening statement. My preference is always to try and find an equity partner. Never family, but an equity partner who you are aware of who contribute to your business.
So let me backtrack for a second. So I have a question. if you go with this factoring or accounts receivable financing, and then you decide, okay, I have enough capital built up now, I want to go on my own, can you just cancel the arrangement, or do they sign you up for a fixed term, or how does that work?
Yeah, they sign you up for a term. Yes, it's possible to cancel.
Okay.
If you've been hugely successful, you can get off the treadmill. But a lot of people find if they've got a growing business, the more the business is growing, the more finance they need to find to get off the treadmill.
Yes.
Whereas my companies don't get on the treadmill in the first place.
Exactly. And is that why you're saying it's very difficult to quit? Because, you know, whenever you go to quit, well, you need more money to finance your next manufacturing run.
I gave you the example of somebody selling a product for $100. Well, let's just say now you've sold 10 products for $100. You've now got $1,000 outstanding, and they've just sent you a check for $900. And you use that, and now suddenly you've got sales of $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get off the treadmill, suddenly you've got to find a way of funding that $20,000. And if you've got a successful business in 3 months' time, it might be $50,000. What they've done is kept you away from the problem in the first place, but all you've done is postpone the problem for further down the road.
Right. Is there a type of account, because this is what was in my head when I thought about accounts receivable financing. I thought about, okay, let's say I went and I just got a huge order from, you know, Walmart, for example. So I have the order. I can show that I have a buyer for this product, and I go to my bank and I say, listen, I need, you know, $250,000 to fund the manufacture of this order, which I have a purchase order in my hand. What is that called, and do banks provide for that, and is that something easy to obtain at a fixed interest rate?
They used to many, many years ago. It's not as common nowadays as it used to be because the margins that the bank are required to make to cover their costs are such that they're looking to charge you 2 or 3%. If you've gone to borrow $250,000 from them, suddenly the bank are taking all the risk with Walmart. Now, you use Walmart as a good example, but if it was John Smith or somebody, the bank wouldn't be interested, and they then want to charge you more for doing that.
Right. Gotcha.
But the banks aren't our friends anymore.
Right.
They used to be. But I don't find bankers as friendly nowadays as they used to be because they don't want to take any risk.
Yeah, exactly.
They're great if they want to come along and give you money for a mortgage, but there's not so much risk in that because they've got the bricks and mortar of the house.
Exactly.
But if you've got a contract from Walmart, whether it's the nuts and bolts or whatever it happens to be, it's risk. And banks are very much adverse to risk at the moment.
So aside from, okay, so we've covered the accounts receivable, the factoring. We've covered the looking for an equity partner who also has more than just money to bring to the deal. Are there any other sources? Are there any other type of financing companies that, because this seems to me like a niche, like waiting to be filled by some kind of financier who understands more about how business works and, you know, can assess risk, you know, has a metric to assess risk for entrepreneurial companies. And are there any institutions like that or companies like that in existence where you can go for financing?
Not to my knowledge. However, let me answer your question in a somewhat strange way.
Yeah.
There are a lot of guys out there and ladies out there that have made their money, that also are trying to get a decent return on their investment.
Right.
But nowadays, you can't go to the bank and put in $100,000 in the bank and earn 8 or 10% as you used to be able to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of individuals that are sitting on cash.
Mm.
Now, the stock market's at a pretty high level. So somebody to go into the stock market at the moment is not necessarily, the stock market's not buyable at the moment. Yeah, I'm generalizing, but, and therefore, if you're an individual that might have a spare 100,000 or quarter of a million lying around, how can you make money on your money? And there are a lot of people nowadays who would be a lot more receptive now than they would have been in the past to funding a startup business.
Right.
I'm very fortunate to live in a very special golf community. And I can tell you the topic of conversation sometimes in the around the golf table when we finished a round of golf, the number of people who have had approaches from people for funding. Remember, I'm not quite sure what the program's called over here, Dragon's Den?
Yeah.
It's called in Europe. I think it's called Shark Tank over here.
Mm-hmm.
Great television program. But I would suggest to you in golf courses, I'm generalizing golf courses, but it could be in all sorts of different areas, there are a lot of mini Shark Tanks taking place as we speak.
Right.
And I would suggest to you that if I was starting a business today, that's where I would be going to. I'd try and find my own little Shark Tank and find my entrepreneur who would I would want to back me.
And you would do it through some kind of social, like the golfing or something where you're likely to attract, you know, the type of person who has that extra cash looking for a good investment. And so you would make an investment in basically relationship marketing to kind of get to know these people and then kind of, you know, feel out who's where and wait for the opportunities to open up.
I suppose I get 5 to 10 approaches a month, and nearly every one of them are from people I've never heard of.
So how are they finding you?
Somebody has made the effort to find me. And therefore, if somebody makes the effort to find me, then I give them the time of day and I will listen to them. Sometimes
right.
I'll invest and help them out, and sometimes I won't. It often depends on how they found me, because financiers don't grow on trees.
Yes.
And
so I'm totally intrigued by this, Stuart. How would they find you? Like, what are some of the ways that they've gone about this?
I have letters from people I've never heard of, from places I've never heard of, and I say to myself when I get the letter, how on earth did they find out about me?
Uh-huh.
And an awful lot of them are, you then suddenly find that they wrote 1,000 letters, and I just happen to be one of 1,000 people they wrote to.
Hmm.
Those people I don't give the time of day to. But there are some other people who have done their research because they've come to me because of my knowledge on a particular industry.
Right.
No point really coming to ask me to go and fund a factory that's going to put water in a bottle and sell bottled water, because I don't know anything about the bottled water market. But if somebody came to me and asked me something about the restaurant industry or portion control or I'll give you a perfect example. And you're not going to believe this, but this is absolutely 100% true. I flew to England 2 weeks ago. I was sitting in the Delta lounge, and my wife said to me, do you fancy a beer? So we ordered 2 beers, and the guy brought the beers to me, and he went to me, you're Stuart Thompson. You're the guy that made all that money out of packing sugar packets.
Oh, my goodness.
He was the server in the Delta lounge. We immediately went back to his workstation, came back with a diagram and a sample of a new way of packing sugar. He had no idea that I was going to arrive in his lounge, but he and I now have got a dialogue going. Will I finance him? I don't know. If I don't finance him, I promise you I'm going to help him. Whether I put money in or not, or whether I just mentor him, he'll get something from me because he was clever enough, realized who. And do you know how he knew me?
Huh.
He used to be a server in the country club I live in.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
But there are thousands and thousands of areas like that that some of your friends and some of your customers can go and find them. It depends whether they're prepared to make the effort.
Yes, to make the effort to research really thoroughly their entire industry, all the different, you know, ways you know, the different cogs in that industry, ways that, like you said, when we were talking about finding an equity partner, maybe they're not in the same industry, but they're in a parallel industry, or they're in an industry that shares a key facet of your own business. Research them thoroughly, contact them, like this guy. I mean, even if he didn't know you before, if he'd looked you up and found a photograph of you, he still would have been able to recognize you when you walked in. Like, that level of preparedness would, you know, go a long way to convincing a financier that, you know, you're worth backing.
I'll give you another perfect example, and I'm now going to take you back 3 years ago. There was a young 22-year-old budding entrepreneur that had the idea of taking an orange cordial and a blackcurrant cordial. In Europe, it's called squash. It doesn't translate over to North America. But he had the idea of taking a portion of orange cordial and putting it in a stick. And the idea was people were getting fed up and suffering from flavor boredom with water. And his concept, very simply, was to take the equivalent of a sugar stick, have orange cordial, and pour that cordial into the neck of a bottle, and suddenly you had a bottle of orange.
Yes.
And he also had the idea of later down the road, he wanted to put the daily usage of vitamins, and this is, might be much more relevant to your business, Ginny, he wanted to put in the average person's daily requirement of vitamins into that orange.
Right.
And he went and did his research. And he found out that I was the guy that pioneered the sugar stick.
Yeah.
So right out of the blue, I had a business proposal.
Mm-hmm.
He'd done his research. He'd done his business plan. I wound up investing an awful lot of money in that business.
Nice.
And now his business, his vote, this is weird, this is how history repeats itself, his votes have... Well, his shares have two votes. My shares have one vote.
Did you tell him how to structure it that way?
Yes, I did.
Excellent.
And, but the idea of doing the vitamins in the drink, I said to him, forget that. Go and put that in the safe for 3 years. Don't even go close to it because you can't climb Mount Everest on one day.
Right.
So he launched the business. And now it's hugely successful in England. Even to try and bring some humour to the conversation, if you're a prisoner and you get arrested in England and you're put in a prison cell overnight, they give you a bottle of water. Well, now they give you a bottle of water and an orange squash stick.
You're kidding me.
So you can flavour the water while you sit in your prison cell.
Oh, that is unbelievable.
That business now... in hospitals, dieticians are worried about hydration.
Yeah.
So they're now putting squash sticks in a next to a hospital bed in the hope that the patient will drink more water because the water will be flavored.
Right.
The lesson that people need to learn is it's 6 months away, but now he's going to launch his vitamin product. He's registered the name Vit Sticks. And he's now going to start marketing the average person's daily vitamin requirement. And you can put that into a bottle of water. But he started small. He did his research. He found me. And at the end of the day, he didn't have to put any money up. I put all the money up.
Right.
And that
Very
was a much
nice.
Better way of funding his business than going to the bank. Because he'd already been to the bank. And he owed the bank a lot of money from his student loan.
Right. So the bank wasn't willing to give him a dime.
No, not a penny. Yeah. He put the business plan to the bank and they turned him down.
So I want to just ask you, going back to what you said, okay, so you'd already run two incredibly successful companies in the UK, and we're not talking, you know, hundreds of thousands. We're talking $25 million companies. You go to the bank in the United States. They can look at your track record, they can look at your, and they still want you to, you know, personally guarantee it by putting up your house or something. I mean, that to me is insane.
That's exactly what they did to me. It was 1999. I wandered into a very well-known bank. For obvious reasons, I won't mention the name. I sat down with my business plan. I showed them my resume as to who I was and said, I'm bringing the sugar stick to the United States. Here's my plan. I'm going to open a bank account. I need a bank account, but I'd like a working overdraft of only $20,000. And at that stage, I was a multimillionaire.
And were you? Did you say to them, I'm willing to deposit this much into the account? Like, were you saying?
I showed them how much money I was putting into the company, which I was going to use to buy equipment and machinery.
So that's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Ginny, here's the crazy thing about it. I leased property. Once I'd explained to the landlord who I was and what I was doing, he didn't ask me for any guarantees. He was happy that I would pay him the monthly rent for the lease. But the bank wouldn't lend me any money because they wanted a personal guarantee. So I looked at the bank man and said, okay, you've just missed your opportunity. Here's a check for 20 grand. Bank it the account. I'm opening the account. I don't need your overdraft. And in the end, I created the business because I could fund it myself. But he wouldn't budge. Had I not had the money, he'd have let me leave his office, and I wouldn't have got. We wouldn't have done any business together.
That's really good to know, because even for myself, for my own business, there's been a part of me that's been thinking, well, when I get to the stage where my business is just, you know, $10-20 million, of course the banks are going to work. And to find out that no, you can get to that business, that stage, and pass it, and the darn banks still aren't going to give you any money. That's really mind shifting for me. So I think that's super, super important. That
to also, Ginny, to cut across you, to square the circle, so to speak, one of the banks in America would lend you the money, and then we'd like your accounts receivable as security.
What does that mean?
Meaning that they'll lend you want to borrow $50,000? If you've got $50,000 on your accounts receivable, they'll lend you the $50,000. But therefore, if you didn't manage to pay your debt and you defaulted on your loan, they would go back and they would take the collateral of your customer list and your accounts receivables.
Right.
It's another way of business factoring or funding. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Anyway.
But that, to me, sounds like a better option than factoring, because you're not agreeing to a payout up front. And it sounds like a better option than a personal guarantor, because you're not risking your property, your house. And they're only going to go after that accounts receivable financing if you can't pay back the loan. But now here's a key question. For that type of a loan, would that be a term loan, or would that be a loan that they could recall at any time?
That would normally be a term loan, but I don't want to mislead you. It depends on your customer list. It's great if you've got a list of well-known blue-chip customers that you're going to be selling your product to.
Right.
If you're going to be supplying your products to Fred's Restaurant and Joe's Bowling Alley and somebody's cafe, the bank wouldn't be interested.
Yes, exactly.
It all depends. I don't want to mislead people and think that they would be able to walk into the bank and get that loan based on that idea.
Right.
And if you're doing that in your own business, it depends on who your customer base is as to whether the bank are prepared to fund it. I repeat, if there's any risk to it, the bank wouldn't be interested in funding it.
Right. Now, so what's your opinion then on venture capital?
Venture capital is another description for me finding an equity partner. I'm very much in favor of venture capitalists.
But again, with the qualification that they bring something more than just money to the deal.
Absolutely. There are plenty of venture capitalists out there, but what can they do for your business? What experience do they have? Coming back to the Shark Tank. If you were going on the program and you had your product and you were looking to raise capital, you initially could make the mistake of saying, which one of the sharks will lend me the money or invest the money? But before you went into that environment, you would have done your research as to the four people sitting around the table and saying, that's the one I want to target because that person has experience in my industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you because can't put a price, Ginny, on experience.
No, because the other thing is if the person does not have experience in your industry, they're going to cause you all kinds of hassle because they don't understand your business. And they think they have a better idea than you, but because they don't understand it, they're just going to end up getting in the way.
Absolutely right. Come back to the squash sticks guy. He found me, but in a way, you could say he went into the shark tank and he had targeted which one of the sharks he wanted to fund his business.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he picked me and therefore knew exactly what I was going to do to help him. Because I had the experience in the marketplace he was looking at.
Exactly.
There was no point in going to a venture capitalist who had made all their money by building motor cars.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does motor cars have to do with putting stuff inside a bottle of water?
Yeah, and I think that's something that until people get into it, they can't really understand the amount of hassle the wrong partner can bring to your daily life. And
okay,
so if, right?
Yep.
So if you do, as you suggested, you find someone who's already in an industry or in an industry that has some kind of cross link, so they really understand, you know, both your manufacturing, your distribution, your retail, like every, you know, in depth in some or more parts of that, you're going to hugely reduce the amount of time you're going to spend managing your partner.
There's an awful lot of retired people out there. And there's an awful lot of retired people that have an awful lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people that are prepared to be little mini venture capitalists on a one-to-one basis.
Yeah.
And anyone starting a business, go find them.
Yeah.
There's plenty of them out there.
Tell us just quickly why you said never approach family for this kind of financing.
Because in the same way, it's never do business with friends. It's difficult because sometimes you have to make a hard decision, and it's very difficult to make a hard decision if that person's a friend or part of the family. And business can get in the way of breaking up friendships, and business can get in the way of breaking up families.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there any other way that we haven't touched on for someone who is looking to finance either a startup or even a company that's rolling to get the capital needed?
I think you've covered the areas that I'm aware of. I'm
right.
Sure there are many other areas. I don't have the answer to everything, and therefore I've covered the areas that I have experience on, and I haven't covered the areas that I don't have experience on because there would be no point in talking about it if I hadn't done it.
Exactly. Okay, so let me talk, just moving on to a slightly different topic, but still connected. I would like to ask you about the pros and cons of when you need to purchase your, okay, so maybe this is a two-part question. So first part is, because you've had to have offices, you've had to have warehouse space, perhaps you've even owned your own manufacturing facilities. What are the pros and cons of leasing all that property versus buying it? And then the second part of that question is, if you feel it's better to buy certain components of it, like my father had optometry clinics, and for him, he made sure that they purchased both the building and the land that each clinic sat on. So what's your opinion on that? And then do you think it's better to buy it personally or using your company, and what would be the pros and cons of that?
A very good question. I don't think we have enough time to give you the full answer, but let me try and deal with different parts of your question.
Mm-hmm.
Personal experience is I never owned any of the buildings I had any of my factories in because all of my money that I generated, all of my profits, I reinvested into more machinery. One of the criteria that I would have, I would never buy another machine unless I could get the cost of that machine back within 3 years.
Sorry, within how many years?
Within 2 years.
2 years.
A lot of people will say you need a 4 or 5 year payback. I would never buy another sugar packet machine unless I could guarantee I could get the cost of that machine back in 2 years. And therefore, as the business grew and became more and more profitable, and we needed to grow and move from one site to another site, the thought to buy my property never crossed my mind. And the reason was machines made me money. A building didn't make me money. Second comment, later down the road, when I came to sell the companies, on every occasion, the person that bought my company wanted to buy the company. The building became baggage.
Right.
Because they wouldn't want to buy the building. There
right.
was a very close friend of mine who was a massive customer of my American business, who's been trying to sell his company for the last 4 years. The company's hugely profitable, but he bought the building. And the building's not in a nice area. And people have looked at buying his company, but he can't sell the company unless he sells the building with it. He's now 68 years old, and I don't want to embarrass him. If he was listening to this conversation, he'd know who he was. He's never going to sell his business. Because he's never going to sell that factory. So
can he not split? Can he not split the business off from the factory?
Oh yes, 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 yes. You can do that, and that's the thing he's looked at doing. But he has not been successful in solving his problem. If it had been me, the problem wouldn't have happened in the first place. I do not believe you need have any need to own the building that you are running your business from. Pay the rent.
Gotcha.
If you have expertise in running a business, and my business was running packaging machines, I don't want to own a building. It's like me saying this. I own a house, but I don't clean my windows. I employ someone to come and clean my windows because they're a lot better at cleaning their windows than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same way in terms of owning a building. There's an expertise in owning a building. And I'd prefer to concentrate my expertise on running my business rather than owning a building. That's just my own opinion.
And let's say, just a devil's advocate this. Let's say finish. You finish. Finish what you're saying, then I'll come back to it.
I would then say to you, in terms of creating businesses, if you've made millions of dollars and you're now saying, well, I've got all this money, what shall I do with it? Then fine. You might want to think about buying the property. But remember, if you have built your business and your intention is to sell that business, owning the property could, not always, but could be the thing that stops you selling it.
So here's my devil's advocate idea, because you actually just brought it in. I was thinking, all right, let's say if you are in a position and the building you're looking at buying, you think it's such a great purchase because it's in an area that's, you know, on the edges of a gentrification movement, so it's going to be worth a lot more down the road. How about if you're in that kind of a situation, you buy the building personally and then you lease it to your company?
Let me answer that question this way.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I had my business, I would outgrow my property. What happens, Ginny, if you bought your property and then you outgrow it, and then you need to move to another property? You move your company out, but you still own the building that you've left behind.
Yeah, so I guess what you're saying is it's going to fragment your energy because now you're going to become a landlord leasing to some other company. Meanwhile, you still have to find new premises for your own business.
Absolutely, 100%. You've understood my point. I repeat. If with all the money that I was making in my companies, every time we made the money, we invested in another machine. And that machine made me more money. And when I made more money, I bought another machine. Guess what? That machine made me yet more money. Two other comments. I'm on that subject. Stuart has some golden rules. I don't know what the statistics are on how many new businesses succeed, but I know it's in single digits. So for every 100 new companies that start, I think the number's around about 93 go broke. Nobody ever seems to analyze why they go broke, but I have my own theory, and too many people start their own business and they spend the money before they've made it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, my whole comment is, if you're starting a business or you're running a business, make the money. Don't take it out in terms of get rich quickly. Make the money and reinvest the money in the company. In the company.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're good at what you do, that keeps you out of the clutches of the bank. And it is astonishingly the cheapest way of generating new business finance is the money that you've already made in your own company, because it's your money.
Yes. Yes, I think that's where a lot of people go astray. They want to live a certain lifestyle, or they want to increase their lifestyle instead of being content to, you know, live fairly frugally while they just keep, you know, year after year plowing everything back into their business so they can self-finance it.
Another statement I would like to make to you, which I think is absolutely critical, absolute people need to remember that corporations always pay less tax than individuals.
Yes.
And there was a friend of mine who I met not that long ago from England. He was came to visit me in Florida and proudly told me how he'd sold his business, and with the proceeds of his business, he bought 5 apartments. And wasn't he doing well now because he was leasing out those apartments and making a lot of money?
Mm-hmm.
I said, what's the name of the company? And there was a silence.
Oh,
he
no.
Said, it doesn't have a name. I bought the apartments.
Oh, no.
This was a very successful entrepreneur. Made a lot of money. Bought the apartments. Not through a corporation.
Mm.
So even the cleverest people make the dumbest mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations will always pay less tax than individuals.
Exactly. Now,
anyway, I'm probably taking you a bit off topic, so I apologize on that one.
No, it's all good, because I think this stuff is just all bits that feed in, and it's all good knowledge. So let me just ask you, I want to go back to what you said about you bought new machines, okay, but only if you could get back the cost of the machine in 2 years. So here's my question to you. Did you look at using a contract manufacturer, so using someone else's manufacturing facility and someone else's machinery instead of investing all that money in your own?
A big whopping great big yes, I did. I had another one of my supposed be phrases that stuck to me, and that was go into a marketplace, create volume, and then go into manufacture.
Huh.
I'll give you the perfect example. I was very big in sugar and sweetener. I decided that I wanted to get into the condiment and sauce business. So I went to one of the largest condiment and sauce companies and said, hello, this is me. I'd like you to make portions for me. And they said, we'd love to. About 9 months, they made my product for me. The rest of the industry assumed I was making it myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I was big enough to buy a machine, give me a 2-year payback, guess what I did? I bought it in-house. So I went out and bought my machine, sold it out inside about 3 or 4 months, and then bought another one, and suddenly I became almost as big as Heinz were in portions. But to answer your specific question, I went out and had that contract manufactured for me until I was big enough to do it myself.
And is that because you ran your numbers, say, over a 5 or 10 year term and realized that you would be way more profitable from buying your own machines?
Absolutely, yes. And I already knew that, but I'd done my numbers. I never did anything without doing my numbers. I'm an accountant who turned salesman, so I would always do numbers. Numbers, 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 numbers run businesses.
But I guess here's where your personality comes into play, because for me, even if I could make more money owning my own equipment and manufacturing myself, the fact of having to manage all the staff associated with that, I would pay a lot of money to get rid of that, because for me, that's a headache.
I understand that, and I also would agree with you. However, it's all about critical mass. I'll give you another example. Once I was, I'm taking you back now to the mid-80s, we had about 35 packing machines.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat down and we worked out how much money we spent with the printing company to supply me with the packaging material.
Mm.
So we sat down and we said, well, do we go into printing? We looked at it, and buying big printing machines were very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the first two times that we ran the numbers, it wasn't worth doing it. But as we continued to grow, we ran the numbers again and went, wow, we could invest $1 million in buying a print facility. If I could get my $1 million back inside 2 years, as I've already explained, my own standard,
mm-hmm.
so guess what? We went into the print business.
Hmm.
We became self-sufficient in printing. Now, I would agree with you, if I had had to employ 30 or 40 people to do my printing, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Right.
As it was, working three shifts, I employed 9 people, 3 people per shift. And I bought my $1 million printing machine, and guess what? After 2 years, it paid for itself.
And then did you use that just to print your own stuff, or were you taking other clients' printing jobs as well?
I would never have dreamt of supplying anybody else, only myself.
Interesting.
Only myself. And I wouldn't ever have bought a machine with any other intention of supplying anybody. It had to be for me.
Right. Wow. This has been fantastic. So, Stuart, I'm just going to recap what we've covered in this call for people, and then if you want to jump in anywhere and add something or you get an idea stimulated, feel free to hop in. So right at the beginning when we talked about ways to get financing, you shared finding an equity partner who can bring money but also some kind of industry expertise to your company, doing a 50-50 share split, but you retain the A shares, which gives you 2 votes in any decision-making scenario, and your equity partner gets B shares, which only give them 1 vote. So that way, you know, the ownership of the company is split. So if you ever sell the company, everybody cashes out equal. But in terms of the day-to-day running of the company and the growth and the development and which direction, you stay in full control of your company because, you know, that's your right and you know best. The other thing we talked about
Jimmy, can I just interrupt? I don't wish to be rude, but let me stress, that doesn't have to be 50-50.
Right.
It can be 1/3, 2/3. You could have 1/3 of the company because you put 1/3 of the money in. Your outside man might have put 2/3 of the money in, but therefore your shares might have 4 votes and his share only has 1 vote.
Right.
50-50. You can shuffle that the way you want to shuffle it.
Gotcha. That's even more important. Yeah, that's even more important. So no matter how much of the equity ownership is split whichever way, you just make sure that in the number of votes assigned to the A and B shares, you're always going to come out in the control position.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, then we talked about factoring, which is also known as accounts receivable financing. And we talked about why, you know, that's in some cases that may work, but for people to keep in mind that the downside is that if you were to work that out to an equivalent interest rate, you'd probably be paying 10 to 15%. And then you're on a real treadmill because as your business grows, for you to take that back and finance it yourself, you have to, you know, gather and be able to put in more and more money. So it can be really great to get going, but then to really, if you wanted to go that route, you really need to keep a tight eye on it to know when to get out and switch to providing the capital yourself or, again, going back to an equity partner.
Absolutely.
And then you brought up the other thing that there are a lot of individuals sitting on cash. And actually, we didn't talk about this, but you know that inverted population pyramid where the bulk of our population is now in retirement and yep. made a lot of money during the booming 80s. So there's a lot of money sitting around with people who have a lot of time and would, you know, they maybe don't want the work and hassle of growing a business again, but they would sure like to be getting a better return on their money than, you know, 3%.
And they can't put it in the stock market because the stock market is overpriced. And
yeah.
So there are a load of people out there ready and willing to back budding entrepreneurs.
Yeah. And the way to do that is to research, find out, again, who was in your industry, who's now retired, or who maybe has a history of funding some companies that, you know, might be a good fit with yours, or, you know, and then find them, find where they are, approach them directly or through writing a letter, or, you know, maybe you find out, well, they golf at this club, so pay to go golf there a few times a week and see if you can run into them and, or find someone who knows them.
Let me let you into a very big secret.
Uh-huh.
It's no longer a secret once I tell you, but in all of the different companies, while I've been talking to you, I've written down how many companies I created and started and sold, and there were seven. Of those seven companies, all of which we sold for big money, I never owned 100% of any of those companies. Ever.
Very interesting.
Very important statistic. Never, ever owned more than, I think, 60% was the maximum I ever owned of any company.
Right. But you had control of all of them.
I had control of all of them.
Yeah.
I would also add, one of the points, and I'm probably breaking all your rules, one of the points that we haven't talked about, of all the companies I've owned, one of the things I insisted on doing is the following. Let me say my politics are somewhat right of Genghis Khan. However, I do desperately, passionately believe in employee ownership. Every one of my seven companies that I started, once the company became mature and profitable, I allowed my employees to buy equity.
How did you structure that?
We need a whole new conversation.
All right.
I made sure, it depends what country you're in, Ginny, it depends what the tax laws are and so on and on. However, I'll give you a perfect example. In the American company, my graphic artist, who put in $50 to buy equity in the company, got a check when I sold it for $66,000.
Oh, my gosh.
And let me then say to you, I could afford to travel and have expensive holidays and vacations here, there, and everywhere, but I never had to worry about my business because my employees own the business with me. So if somebody would open the factory door, you'd have the fork truck driver saying, "Shut that door, you're letting all the heat in."
Awesome.
They do my job for me.
Yes.
So let me stress to anyone that's listening to this, employee ownership, whatever your politics are, left or right or whatever, look after the people that work for you, because they're your greatest asset.
So now I have to ask you this question. Why do you like giving them ownership versus bonusing them based on sales?
Because somebody once did it to me, and I made money by giving me the opportunity of investing in the company I was working in.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make a lot of money. I made a little bit of money, and I thought it, A, is a lovely way of rewarding your staff, but secondly, it gave me great personal satisfaction that when you complete and sign all the contracts, you suddenly see 50 or 60 people running down the road suddenly feeling that they just won the lottery. So there was a bit of personal indulgence, but it made the business easy to run because they felt that they owned it. The other thing about it, Ginny, no one ever left.
Oh, really?
All the staff stayed because the rule was if they had equity and they wanted to leave, they had to leave their shares behind.
Oh, I see. They couldn't get their money back when they left.
And even more important, of all the seven companies, I never had a trade union request because they didn't need a trade union because it was their company.
Wow. That is brilliant on so many levels.
Sorry,
and so you
I interrupted,
found...
Sorry,
no,
I
no,
interrupted
this is...
your summary.
No, this is gold. This is why we're doing this, to have these pieces come out, because that's often where you get the gold. So you're a graphic designer who only bought $50 worth of equity, energetically emotionally, that was enough to confer upon him that feeling of ownership, and I'm in the fiber of this company?
Absolutely, because what I also did every 3 months, I had a shareholder meeting. And I told them how the company was performing.
So they got to see, wow, my $50 is now worth $2,000. Oh, I see. Oh, Stuart, you are such a genius. I love that. That is, you know, you've given us so much in this call that honestly is worth the price of Listen to Your Freedom membership. Like just each, you know, there's about three pieces you've given us. Just one of those would be worth the price of Listen to Your Freedom membership. So this has been so generous and so fantastic of you. Thank you so much.
Very happy to help.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. I just love that. Okay. So we were back to going to individuals, sitting on cash in your industry, doing your research. And then we had a wonderful little foray into how to get fantastic employees who are motivated for the life of the company. That's so great. Next, we talked about the difference between owning your buildings and leasing them, and why that would be a good or a bad idea. And an important point you brought up is when you assessed whether to purchase new machinery, some people may give it a 5-year, you know, payback limit. You gave it 2 years. You needed to get the cost of that machine back in 2 years or you wouldn't purchase it. And then, of course, we talked about, you know, if you do buy your own building, you know, maybe look at buying it personally and leasing it, but then you have the complication that now you have two businesses. You're now a landlord because, as you rightly pointed out, every building that you've leased, you've outgrown, you know, fairly speedily, and then you need a bigger building, but now you're stuck with the old building that you bought. And then finally, pointing out that a corporation always pays less tax than individuals. So that's another big piece where you need to run your numbers before making any kind of decision like that. So that is just excellent, Stuart. Do you have anything else to add before we say goodbye?
No, I've enjoyed talking to you. Hopefully, if it helps someone, then it's all been worthwhile.
I think so. I think this could just revolutionize the way someone is doing business. And it's just, you know, that's why it's so, so important to speak to people like you who really, you know, it's not like you've had one company and made a success. Like, you've done this 7 times. There's no luck involved here. Like, the information you've given us, this is tried and tested. This is learned over time, and not just different, you know, markets, but different countries even. So it's, I think what you've given us here is about as close to, you know, solid fact as we can get in the business world. And thank you again so much for sharing so candidly and openly with us today.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Stuart.
Ginny, good to talk to you. Take care.